The focus of this module is to look at mental health problems and brain injury. If you are watching this module, it's likely that you have a member of a family who has had a brain injury, and you may be wondering about whether or not they have any mental health problems. They may have already had a mental health problem diagnosed, and the aim of this module will be to help you to have a better understanding about mental health and how it relates to brain injury. Mental health can be defined as an absence of a particular illness, or we can describe it as a person having particular ways of thinking or behaviour that help them to feel good and to maintain how they feel on a daily basis. Typically, though, we talk about mental health problems or mental illness, and we define that as a person having particular symptoms or behaviour that represent certain types of illnesses that psychiatrists or psychologists may diagnose. Why a person might get a mental health problem is related to a number of factors, and there are three important factors. The first is there are biological factors. This could mean that a person has inherited a risk to developing a mental health problem. Certain drugs or medical treatments can cause mental health problems. And finally, people can have damage to various parts of the brain and increase their risk of getting a mental health problem. Another important factor that influences why a person may get a mental illness are psychological factors. When I say psychological, I mean the way the person thinks or feels about a situation. This can often be influenced by how a person is brought up and the kind of environment that they've experienced as growing up. Finally, certain social factors are also known to influence why a person might develop a mental health problem. These social factors include whether or not a person is unemployed and also the level of poverty that they might experience. It's the interaction of all these factors that is likely to influence whether or not a member of your family might develop a mental health problem. Why is it important that we look at mental health problems in brain injury? There are a number of reasons that this is very important. We know that if you have a brain injury, that you've got a significantly higher risk of getting a mental health problem. So if you're aware of this, you can be at a lookout. And part of the aim of this presentation is to give you some of the very common symptoms that people might get in important mental illnesses so that you can identify when this might be becoming a problem. We also know that if you have certain types of mental health problems, that you've actually got a bigger risk for having a head injury. The types of mental health problems that can predispose you to getting a brain injury include illnesses like manic depressive illness or schizophrenia. There are also people who might abuse drugs or alcohol that cause them to take bigger risks than they normally will, and this might increase their risk of having a brain injury. Obviously, if you've got a mental health problem before your brain injury, then that mental health problem is still going to be an issue after the brain injury, but it might change. It might be harder to manage, or some of the symptoms might change. It's important to work out whether a person has a mental illness after a brain injury because it's actually going to affect how that person recovers from the brain injury. So early identification and treatment is really important because the mental health problems that most people get after a brain injury are relatively easy to treat. Before I talk about the different types of mental illness, what I'd like to do is bring you up to speed about some of the different areas of the brain and how they are important as far as why a person might get a mental health problem. It's important to remember, though, that most brain injuries now occur in situations such as car accidents or falls, and those type of injuries cause what we call diffuse brain damage, or lots of areas of the brain are actually affected by the head injury. So typically there isn't one particular area of the brain that's going to be affected. And it's probably this reason that increases the risk for a person to have a mental health problem after their head injury. It's also important to remember that the more severe a person's brain injury, the more likely they are to have a mental health problem. You might be listening to this talk and thinking, oh, I've had a knock on the head and I've had a concussion at sport. Does that mean I'll get a mental health problem? And the answer is generally no. More typically, the kind of mental health problems I'm going to be talking about really only occur when a person has had a significant brain injury, where they've lost consciousness, needed to be in hospital for a period of time, and usually have had some rehabilitation. Now, areas of brain that I'm going to be talking about are mainly four regions of the brain. And what we're going to do is have a look at the model of the brain in the skull. Now, this is a plastic model of the head which has the brain exposed. And the important part about this is that you've got to remember that here the forehead is where the frontal lobes occur. Now, I'm going to take the brain out of the head, and it's not quite as easy in real life, and have a look at half of the brain. This is the front, or the frontal region of the brain. And this is very important for mental health problems. The frontal lobes of the brain are the parts of the brain that help control. They in fact make us who we are. They're important for the regulation of emotion, for initiating behaviour, solving problems, and how we organise our thinking. If you get damage in the frontal areas of the brain, there is quite a high risk of getting a mental health problem. The next very important area of the brain is the temporal lobes. Now, the temporal lobes are particularly important for memory. And if a member of your family has had a brain injury, you've probably heard the rehabilitation specialist talk about damage to the temporal lobes. One of the problems with the temporal lobes is where they are in the skull. They're very vulnerable to getting injured, particularly this area of the brain. And that part of the brain is very important for controlling emotion as well, particularly anger. The next region of the brain is the parietal area. And this part of the brain helps to put all the information together that we're thinking about, all our feelings, and allow us to have some kind of an experience of what's happening. So if we damage the parietal lobes of the brain, there'll be problems of integrating information, so the information is all muddled and confused, and this can lead to mental health problems. However, one of the most important parts of the brain for mental health problems is not very well defined anatomically, and that's called the limbic system. And I'm now turning the brain over to look at the inside, and this is what it would look like if I cut the brain in half. And this region around here, which goes in a loop into the temporal lobes and the frontal lobes, this part of the brain we call the limbic system. It's the most basic and primitive part of our brain, and it's extremely important for controlling emotion. It's also a part of the brain that's particularly vulnerable for getting damaged when you have a head injury. It's unlikely that damage to only one area of the brain is going to cause a mental health problem, and usually it's damage in all these areas that leads to a number of very significant difficulties. Before I go and talk about the various mental health problems, I want to talk about epilepsy. Epilepsy is a condition where the brain has an abnormal electrical discharge, and the person might fall to the floor, have shaking movements. At other times, they can have very strange repetitive movements. It can be very hard to diagnose epilepsy. Epilepsy is not a mental health problem. A person who has epilepsy can't control when they might have an attack or a seizure. But we know that it doesn't actually, it's not a type of mental health problem. Many, many years ago we thought they were, but now we know a lot more about how the brain works. But one of the important things to say about epilepsy, that is if a person has epilepsy, then they actually have a higher risk of getting a mental health problem. And there are very particular types of psychiatric illnesses that people can have with epilepsy. So if you've had a brain injury and you've got epilepsy, then you've got a bigger risk again of having a mental health problem. And we need to keep a very close eye on how you are going and the kind of problems you have. Obviously, if you've had epilepsy for many years and you haven't had any mental health problems, that's not likely to be an issue. One of the most important mental health problems that you can get after a brain injury is a condition called depression. Now, depression is a very tricky word because it can describe a symptom, I feel depressed today. It can also be part of an illness, so you can have, for example, schizophrenia and have depressive symptoms. And of course, psychiatrists can talk about it as if it's an illness. Often people can get confused. They might say, oh, I feel depressed today, and that doesn't necessarily mean they have a depressive illness. And it's usually the job of a psychiatrist or a psychologist to make the diagnosis of a depressive illness. When psychiatrists talk about depression, they use a whole number of different words to describe different types of depressive illnesses. But the common ones that a psychiatrist might talk about is a major depression or a minor depressive illness. And often we use these different terms to try and communicate to other doctors or health professionals what we mean as psychiatrists. And also the kind of treatments we might use are often influenced by the type of diagnosis that a person has. Now, depression can be a reaction to a situation. So, for example, our boyfriend leaves us or someone who we really care about dies, and we might develop a depressive illness. Depression, however, can also be a biochemical imbalance. That is that there are particular chemicals in the brain that are important for how we feel about our mood. If we get a disturbance in that balance of chemicals, so we don't have enough, or maybe we've even got too much, then we can develop a depressive illness. Often, depression that people get after a brain injury, in fact, is a combination of both the chemical and the reaction situation. We know that depression is a lot more common after a brain injury. Depression is actually common in the community, and in fact, about 1 in every 10 people will at some stage get a depressive illness. If you have a brain injury, your risk for that increases by about 2 to 3 times, so that a lot more people who've had a brain injury are going to at some stage develop a depressive illness, and obviously they're going to need treatment. The earlier after the brain injury a person develops depression, the more likely it's going to be due to a disturbance of chemicals in the brain that has happened as a result of the brain injury. Psychosis is another type of mental health problem that you can get after a brain injury. Psychosis is a generic term. It really is a term that we use to describe a particular group of symptoms. People who have a psychosis may have hallucinations. That's where they see or experience things that aren't really happening. And auditory hallucinations, such as hearing voices, are the commonest type of hallucinations that people might get. Another part of a psychosis is what's called delusions. Now, delusions are when people have an abnormal idea. They believe this idea, and despite giving them evidence to show that their idea isn't true or valid, they still hold the idea. For example, a person might believe that they are being poisoned. Any type of food that's given to them, they're not going to eat because they think that food is poisoned. No amount of reassurance is going to stop them thinking that they are being poisoned. And that's what we call a delusional idea. Finally, people can have problems organising their thoughts, which means that when they speak, it doesn't make a lot of sense. We call this a psychiatrist's thought disorder. Now, thought disorder is very rare in a psychosis that happens after a brain injury. However, people who have a brain injury can have problems just organising their own thoughts without having a psychosis. So it's always really important that if you think a person's having some of these symptoms, to talk to a health professional about it. Some of the typical terms that you might hear when a person has a psychosis is schizophrenia or manic depressive illness. The common feature between both of these illnesses is that a person will have psychotic symptoms. Interestingly enough, when people have a brain injury, their psychotic illness is actually very different to schizophrenia and depression. And we know that over the longer term, they don't have the same kind of number of episodes of illness as someone who has schizophrenia or manic depressive illness might have. A lot of the patients that I take care of who have a psychosis get very upset when someone suggests that they have schizophrenia because they themselves know that their illness is really quite different. But there are many characteristics that can be similar, and it can be sometimes very hard to distinguish between schizophrenia and a person who has a psychosis because they've had a serious brain injury. Psychosis after a head injury, in fact, is quite rare. Psychosis in the community generally is pretty rare. Only about 1 to 2% of the population will ever have a psychotic illness. But if you have a brain injury, again, your risk goes up by about 2 to 3 times. So about 3% of people who have a brain injury might develop a psychosis at some stage after the illness. Again, the closer the illness occurs to the time the person's had the head injury, the more likely we are to say that the psychosis happened because of the brain injury. You may have a family member who got knocked on the head when they were about 11 or 12, and then when they were in their mid-20s, they developed a psychosis. It's unlikely that the brain injury in this situation has actually caused the psychotic illness. One of the things I can say about a psychosis is that it's always caused by a chemical imbalance, and so medication is always going to be a part of the management of this illness. Anxiety problems are very common after a brain injury. People may be anxious as part of another illness, or they may have an anxiety disorder in their own right. There are a whole number of anxiety conditions that people can have, but there are a few common ones that people have after a brain injury. Often people will have an anxiety about a particular situation. They might have what we call a car phobia. If you've had a serious accident in a motor vehicle, you might get very anxious and frightened when you're in a car, and we would call this a specific phobia or a car phobia. At other times, people might get anxious about being out in public. They might experience something called panic attacks, or have obsessions and compulsions, or have what we call obsessive compulsive disorder. And there are lots of movies made by Hollywood about obsessive compulsive disorder, and so often it's an illness that's actually quite easily recognised by family members. It's also, though, very important to know that many people after a brain injury, because they are forgetful, will tend to be very ordered and particular about how they do things. So they might have some obsessional features, but they won't necessarily have an obsessive compulsive disorder. Again, as with any of the symptoms I talk about, if you're worried that the person might be more than just a little bit obsessional about things so that they can remember what they've done, and you think that it's causing problems, that's when you go and speak to someone about it, be it your rehabilitation team, or someone within the community or your family doctor. We know that anxiety disorders following a brain injury are usually a combination of a biochemical problem as well as a reaction to the situation that the person finds themselves in. And that's going to give us a bit of a clue about how we take care of people with anxiety problems. One of the biggest areas of difficulty after a brain injury, in fact, is personality change. I have to be honest that most psychiatrists find it sometimes very difficult to define what we mean by personality, and it can be very hard to describe one's own personality. However, after a brain injury, we know that often people's personality, who they are, what they were like, how they react to situations, is changed by the fact that they've had a brain injury. Now, all the changes in personality don't have to be bad, they can in fact be positive, but that's pretty rare. We do know that most people who've had a severe brain injury will have some change in their personality after they've had that brain injury. So it's very common. And typically what happens is that they get an exaggeration of their personality. So it's not like they become someone completely new. It's not a Jekyll and Hyde situation. But really, if they might have been a bit fussy, they become very fussy. If they tended to get easily cranky before, now they get even more easily cranky. So it's an exaggeration of how they were. One of the biggest problems we have after a brain injury is for those people who have problems controlling their emotions or aggression. And not only do rehabilitation specialists find that a huge challenge, but also psychologists, family members, and people within the community. Some of the personality changes that often don't get talked about, but can be really frustrating, particularly for carers, are the changes in personality where a person is less motivated. So they're very flat, they don't do anything, they don't seem to have any kind of motivation to get up and do things. And in fact, they talk about, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, but they actually never get to do it. And they have a problem with drive or initiative. And this is a very difficult change in personality because it can be very hard to treat, and often people don't understand what it's about, and so they think the person is lazy. The biggest problem, though, with changes in personality is usually that the person who has the change in personality isn't aware that they're different. So everyone will say, oh, now you do this, or you weren't like that before, and the person who's got the brain injury is completely unaware of it. Now, that causes a lot of frustration and also can cause a lot of misunderstanding. But we know that the front part of the brain, particularly the right front part of the brain or the right frontal cortex, is really important for recognising or being aware of things. So if you damage that area, you're going to have a big problem being aware of what's going on. And it's the people that have damage to the right frontal area that often don't recognise that their personality has changed. I want to very briefly talk about a psychiatric illness that we call post-traumatic stress disorder. Other people might know it as Vietnam War syndrome. There's now something called Gulf War syndrome, and they're all very similar in the types of symptoms that people have. A number of years ago, people thought that if you had a severe brain injury, you didn't get a post-traumatic stress disorder. But there have now been some really good studies looking at people who've had severe brain injury, and we recognise that post-traumatic stress disorder can happen when someone's had not only a mild brain injury, but a severe brain injury. Typically, post-traumatic stress disorders happen to people when they've been in a really bad experience. So if you've been in a really bad car accident, you know, you might remember up until the point of the accident, and it's those aspects of your memory that form part of the post-traumatic stress disorder. People who have post-traumatic stress disorder often relive aspects of the trauma. They'll also have difficulties as far as avoiding situations where they might get memories of the trauma. They may not want to talk about it, and they can be quite jumpy and nervous. It's in fact a lot more common than we originally thought, and sometimes people will only have some symptoms of post-traumatic stress. Where it gets really difficult is that sometimes you can confuse the cognitive or thinking problems of a brain injury with the symptoms of a post-traumatic stress disorder. And it takes a very skilled psychologist to be able to work out the differences. So I've spoken about some of the common types of mental health problems, and I'm going to go into more detail about them. But you might be saying, well, why worry about mental health problems? Why should we bother about it? The person's got enough to deal with by having had a brain injury, so let's not pay attention to the mental health problems they might get. Well, there are some very important reasons why we, in fact, do have to worry about mental health problems after a brain injury. If you develop a mental illness after a head injury, then your ability to recover from your brain injury is, in fact, adversely affected. You're not going to get as well as you possibly could. So because everyone wants to get as well as they can after a brain injury, it's important that we not only recognise it, but treat the problems. Interestingly enough, if you've got a mental health problem, you can actually have a much bigger risk of having other problems. For example, heart disease, there's a higher risk of having things like diabetes, and people don't seem to do enough exercise and take care of themselves as well. So they've got a much bigger risk of becoming sick from other problems, and in fact a much bigger risk of actually dying when you've got a mental health problem. So we need to work out very quickly what's going on and do something about it. One of the biggest challenges for me, though, is to try and recognise whether a person's got a mental health problem before they get in trouble with the police, because some of the problems that people get after a brain injury that are in the area of mental health just mean they end up with contact of the police, they go to court, and they can in fact sometimes end up in jail. In countries like America, where there isn't a very good legal system for people who don't have good incomes, many people who are in jails in fact have had a significant brain injury. In Australia, that's not as much of a problem, but it still is a significant problem and something we'd like to avoid. And finally, if you've got a family member with a mental health problem, you have a lot of stress. If you've got a family member with a brain injury, you have stress already. You don't want to make it worse with the mental health problem. So we need to try and identify and treat these problems. Well, who do you go to? If you think someone in your family or even yourself have a mental health problem related to your brain injury, who is going to help you? This is sometimes the biggest challenge. There's a lot of stigma in our community about mental health problems. People are embarrassed or ashamed. They think they should be able to fix the problem themselves. And so it can be very hard to go and talk to someone about some mental health problems, particularly if something's happening like you're hearing voices or you believe things that no one else believes. You're often quite ashamed and embarrassed about it. Obviously, one of the most important factors that's going to influence who you see for your mental health problem is where you live. In various parts, particularly of New South Wales, we have a marked shortage of mental health professionals. We even have a shortage of general practitioners. So it can be very difficult to go and see someone. It's important to know who is in your local community who is able to help you. If you're being treated by a brain injury team or the member of your family has a brain injury specialist, that's one port of call where you can go and speak to someone. Most brain injury teams will have a psychologist or a psychologist who works with them, who'll be able to see you and speak to you about the problems you're having and probably even make a diagnosis, provide treatment or recommend certain types of treatment. Rehabilitation specialists are also quite skilled in making diagnoses and assessments of mental health problems. A lot of these problems they can actually treat as well, and often will only refer on if the problem's a little bit more difficult or that the first type of treatment they've tried hasn't actually worked. General practitioners are also very good at dealing with mental health problems, and you could see your family doctor. And finally, you might be referred to a psychiatrist for assessment and management of a mental health problem after a brain injury. There is nothing embarrassing about seeing a psychiatrist. They are a doctor, like any other health professional, but they simply specialise in looking at mental health problems. They'll be sympathetic to the problems that you have and hopefully be able to explain to you so that you can understand better why the problems have occurred. Typically, what tends to happen and what I've seen happen over the years is that someone in the rehabilitation team will work out that you might be depressed or having some mental health problems and make the necessary referrals so that the person gets the appropriate help. There are a whole range of different types of services for where you can get help if you have a mental health problem. A lot of people think that if you have a mental health problem, it means you get taken to a psychiatric hospital, locked up, and the keys thrown away. We in fact don't admit very many people with mental health problems now. Only the most severe people, the most severely ill people with mental health problems will ever come into hospital. And usually they'll only come to hospital if they are wanting to kill themselves or they're causing serious harm to other people. So the majority of people with mental health problems are actually managed at home in the community with their family where they live. So you don't need to be worried that if you or a family member have a mental health problem that they're going to be taken away. There is in fact a fairly reasonable shortage of beds, of mental health beds in New South Wales, and so the chances of being admitted are in fact quite low. There are private psychiatric services that can be available for people with mental health problems. But of course, one of the problems with private services is that people have to pay for them. A lot of mental health teams are going to be fairly unhelpful about dealing with mental health problems related to brain injury. And part of the process of this talk is to try and help educate people about the interface between mental health and brain injury. And hopefully in the future, mental health teams are going to be more receptive about offering help for people with a brain injury. So let's talk a little bit more about depression. As you might remember, I said that depression is probably one of the most common types of mental health problems that someone will have after a brain injury. If the mental health problem, the depression, is due to a chemical imbalance, it's often going to start fairly early. And the typical picture you see is that someone's emerged from post-traumatic amnesia, so they're now starting to remember things, they're having their rehabilitation, they're going along quite well, and within a few weeks they start to get very depressed, they become much more negative, they don't think they're going to get better. And sometimes they'll find they have problems with sleeping, their appetite will go down, they'll lose weight, they become more teary than they were, and they'll really slow down in everything that they do. So that while they were getting better from their brain injury, they seem to be getting worse. And that's often because they've got this chemical imbalance and they have what we call a major depression. The reactive type of depression tends to happen much later, and usually around the 2-year mark. Now, if you've had a brain injury, you'll be aware that most of the time the doctors will say to you that we can't say how well you're going to get or how much of a recovery you've had until about 2 years after your brain injury. This is an arbitrary point that's been determined by rehabilitation specialists, at which time they can say, this is probably as good as you're going to get. In the first 2 years, there is ongoing recovery of brain function, and it doesn't mean that people don't get better after the 2-year mark, it's just that the rate of recovery is a lot slower. And so often we don't notice the changes as much. And a lot of the recovery that happens after 2 years tends to be an adaptation to the changes that happen. Now, in many patients that I see with a reactive depression, what's happened is that they've gone along and they've thought, oh, the 2 years aren't here yet, I'll keep getting better, I'll keep getting better. And come the 2-year mark and they've still got some problems and they get very depressed and very sad. And effectively what they're doing is they're mourning or grieving for the loss of the person that they were and the things that they can't do anymore and struggling with that. And whenever anyone loses something, something that's important to them, who they are, what they can do, or even someone very close to them, often people will get depressed for a period of time. Sometimes what happens is that the reactive depression can be so severe that it actually causes a biochemical imbalance in the brain. Now, we have many different ways of managing depression. For the biochemical imbalance, we often do need to use medication. Interestingly enough, the combination of counselling and medication is going to work much better than medication alone. For the reactive depression, counselling, or a treatment called cognitive behaviour therapy, is really important and helps most people to get better. Psychologists, psychiatrists and general practitioners can be trained in doing cognitive behaviour therapy and counselling. For a person to get antidepressants, though, they must see a doctor. Now, antidepressants are the commonest treatment for the biochemical problems and for the more serious types of depression. Antidepressants are always prescribed by a doctor, be it the rehabilitation specialist, the psychiatrist, or the family doctor. And I've provided a list of some of the common names of antidepressants that we now use. Most of these antidepressants are very easy to prescribe, and the family doctors are typically the people who'll start the medication. They're fairly well tolerated. There's no medication that doesn't have any kind of side effects, but typically the side effects are quite brief. They'll go away if you persist with taking the medicine. Now, there are some tricks with taking antidepressants in that if you think that you take an antidepressant and you're going to feel better straight away, you're actually going to be sadly disappointed. The antidepressants are going to change the level of chemicals in the brain, and to do that it actually takes some time. So most people don't start to feel better with antidepressants for at least a week, if not longer. And sometimes after a brain injury, it can take 6 weeks before the antidepressants start to work. So one of the important things that you need to remember if you've been prescribed antidepressants is that you need to keep taking them even if you don't feel better. Usually when you started on an antidepressant, the doctor will see you about a week to 2 weeks after you've started the medicine to see how you're going. Hopefully by then any side effects you've got from the treatment will be going away. One of the important things to remember though with an antidepressant is once it starts working and you feel a lot better, you just can't stop it. If you stop it very suddenly, the underlying chemical imbalance will come back really quickly. And most people have to take antidepressants for about 9 to 12 months, if not longer. Sometimes after a brain injury, the treatment needs to be for about 2 years. Generally, when the depression's improved a little bit, most people will have some cognitive behaviour therapy with a psychologist as well to try and help the person to develop some strategies to stop the depression coming back when the doctor tells them that they can stop taking the antidepressants. An important thing to remember is if you've got a depressive illness and you're prescribed antidepressants, that alcohol is going to make the antidepressants less effective. So if you're drinking a lot of alcohol because you want to try and feel better and alcohol numbs your feeling, it's going to stop your antidepressants from working, so you need to stop drinking your alcohol. However, once you're well, you might want to go out and have a drink or two, but probably no more than two, and antidepressants are usually then quite safe in combination with alcohol in moderate quantities occasionally. The one antidepressant that I've listed that isn't safe with alcohol is the medication called triptanol and some of the more old-fashioned antidepressants, and I encourage you to talk to your doctor who's prescribed the antidepressants about whether or not it's safe for you to have one or two drinks once you're well. The next type of mental health problem that I want to talk about in greater detail is that of a psychosis. Now, psychotic illnesses are actually very hard to diagnose, and often as much information that a person can get, the mental health professional can have, will help them to make that diagnosis. The problem with psychosis is that the kind of symptoms that most people know means that you're mad or ill. For example, everyone in the community knows that hearing voices means that you're mentally ill. So people are going to be very embarrassed about talking about hearing voices. If they've got ideas that are delusions, then they're going to stop telling people about the delusions because they're tired of hearing someone say, oh, that's not true, that's rubbish, don't talk about that. So in fact, they don't. That then proves to be a real challenge for the mental health professional because if they don't get the symptoms, it's difficult to make the diagnosis. The other thing about a psychosis is that a person can often control the symptoms or not talk about them when they're seeing the mental health professional. So if a member of your family has the type of symptoms I described earlier, the hallucinations, the delusions, then it's important to go along and tell the mental health professional what you know about what they're doing. It might be the only clue that there's something more serious going on. Often I'll talk to someone and I think, oh, I can't find anything wrong with that person, what am I going to do? And then the family member or carer will come in and say, well, you know, they're doing this at the middle of the night, they're locking all the doors, they're talking about people breaking in, and then I can ask more questions and actually find out the kind of symptoms that are important for making the diagnosis. A psychosis can start any time after the head injury, but again, the usual rule is that the closer to the time of the head injury, the more likely it is to be caused by the brain injury. And damage to the temporal areas of the brain are actually really important for why people get psychotic illnesses. Now, one of the really frightening things about a brain injury is the role that marijuana or cannabis can have in starting off a psychosis. I've seen many young adult males, because the males seem to smoke more marijuana than the females, who used to be able to smoke marijuana before their head injury without any problems. And then after their head injury, they tend to go back to smoking the marijuana. They're bored, it's something to do, it stops them from feeling restless and agitated, and then they develop a psychosis. We don't know why this happens, but we do know that it's a very common problem, and if the person stops smoking the marijuana, often the psychosis doesn't go away, so it then develops a life of its own, and then you need to have treatment for the psychosis. If people smoke marijuana while being treated for the psychosis, then the medication also doesn't work. I mentioned before that a psychosis after a brain injury is not like schizophrenia, and this is actually a very important feature about the differences between the two. Most people develop schizophrenia when they're young adults, between the ages of 16 and 25, and people who've had a head injury will often develop the psychosis at any stage after their brain injury, so someone who's 40 can develop a psychotic illness. We don't really know what the risk factors are, apart from the fact that if you've got temporal lobe epilepsy and you've had damage to your temporal regions of the brain, you've got a slightly higher risk of getting a psychosis. Sometimes the only sign of a person having a psychosis is that they're aggressive and they're very irritable and quite irrational in the conversations you have with them. Psychosis, as I mentioned in the early parts of the talk, is always a biochemical problem and we always need to use medication to treat it. There are two big families of antipsychotics. There are the old-fashioned antipsychotics, and drugs like Largactyl or Serenace belong in this old-fashioned group, and there are the more modern antipsychotics. There are huge differences between them in that the more modern antipsychotics have much fewer side effects. They don't seem to cause problems with how the person thinks in terms of their memory function, and they don't get side effects that affect their neurological system. Some of the old-fashioned antipsychotics slow down how people move, or they find that they can't go out into the sun. And the more modern antipsychotics don't cause these problems. One of the important things to say, though, is that sometimes antipsychotics are used for problems apart from psychosis. They can be used for treating anger control. So if you've got a member of the family who's on some of the drugs that are listed there and think, oh, they must be psychotic, that may not be the case. The doctor might have started them because they're having problems controlling their anger, and the antipsychotics can at times help with controlling anger. An important thing to know is that the more modern antipsychotics can be very expensive to use, and so the doctor may not be able to use it if the person doesn't have a psychosis. As I said before, antipsychotics do not mix well with illegal drugs, particularly marijuana, and in fact if a person smokes marijuana and is taking an antipsychotic, the antipsychotic can't work. People who develop a psychosis after a brain injury often need to have quite long-term treatment, and this is something that you're going to need to discuss with the doctor. We also use social treatments for psychosis, such as talking therapies. Sometimes people need help with how to mix with people in the community again, but often we need to treat the psychosis first, get the symptoms under control before the talking therapies can occur. Anxiety disorders, as I said, are actually quite common, and they're often missed. And part of the reason they're missed is that people often see anxiety as being normal in a particular situation. So, for example, if a person's had a car accident and they're anxious about being in a car, everyone says, oh, well, look, that's pretty normal and it will go away. Well, in fact, it doesn't go away. And typically, people need to have treatment for these kinds of fears and anxieties. The anxiety can be really disabling, and it very commonly occurs in combination with depression. If you've got both anxiety and depression, then you really need to have a lot of help and you need to get it fairly quickly because the combination of the two problems can cause lots and lots of difficulties. Some of the common anxiety conditions that we talk about is a panic disorder, and this is when people have something called panic attacks where they suddenly feel quite frightened, they'll breathe too fast, they'll think something terrible or bad is going to happen to them. Often they notice their heart's pounding in their chest, and if they have a panic attack in a place like a shopping centre or a place where there are lots of people, they'll often try and take themselves away from that. Sometimes people with panic attacks refuse to leave their home and they have something we call agoraphobia. It's very rare for a person to get agoraphobia and not have panic attacks. One of the more common anxieties that people get after a brain injury, in fact, is a condition called social phobia, where they avoid meeting and mixing and talking with people. And this typically occurs to people who have some kind of language problem associated with their brain injury. Probably one of the least common effects of brain injury, but one of the ones that can be the most disabling, are the obsessive-compulsive disorders. Obsessive-compulsive disorders are where people do things repetitively and often with a ritual. The commonest one is a hand-washing ritual. The person has some kind of belief about being easily contaminated or that there are germs everywhere, and they have to go and wash their hands. But they don't just go and wash their hands once. They often wash their hands for half an hour at a time. And that's the most typical type of obsessive-compulsive disorder. Other people might have rituals about counting, how they do things, and the obsessive-compulsive symptoms can be really, really disabling because they stop people getting to places on time. Someone with obsessive-compulsive symptoms can get very angry and aggressive if someone stops their rituals, and they can also become very distressed and worried about the symptoms. For the anxiety conditions that people get after a brain injury, we typically suggest that they have psychological treatment before they have medication. And some of the types of treatment that you might have includes relaxation training, where you're taught how to relax and manage your anxiety. And other times people are taught to control their breathing, or they're given techniques to try and challenge their thought processes that make them anxious. For people with obsessive compulsive disorder, we often try and get them to stop the ritual and manage the anxiety and learn that they don't have to do the ritual because nothing bad will happen if they don't carry out the ritual. Interestingly enough though, with brain injury, often we need to also use medication for people with obsessive compulsive disorders. The commonest medication treatments that we get for the anxiety disorders are what are called the anxiolytics. Now, I said before that it's important that behaviour or psychological treatments be given first, and the main reason for this is the effect that some of the medications have. The most readily prescribed treatments for anxiety are in fact anxiolytics, and the names such as Ducine, Valium, Serapax or Xanax are some of the common drugs that will be prescribed. These drugs work very quickly to get rid of the anxiety symptoms, so they're really effective. You might think, well, they should be prescribed all the time, but they have a really big drawback in that they actually are highly addictive. And for that reason, we don't encourage people with anxiety disorders to be started on the anxiolytics because it gets very hard to stop them. The other thing is that the anxiolytics actually mask the symptoms of the anxiety, but they don't treat the underlying problem. So the person never learns how to cope with it without medication. Some of the more modern antidepressants, the ones we call the SSRIs, and that's short for something called serotonin selective reuptake inhibitor, they're antidepressants, but we also know that they're really effective for managing anxiety conditions. So people who've got an anxiety disorder and the counselling therapy hasn't helped to control their symptoms might be started on some of these antidepressants. Names such as Zoloft or Cyprimil are some of the typical SSRI medications that are used for anxiety and can be very effective. We tend to leave medication for the more severe problems, for people who are really have a lot of problems with following the behaviour therapy because of their memory problems, or who can't remember to use the strategies when they're in situations that cause them to be anxious. Often if you've got an anxiety problem and you need medication, you're going to need to be on it for quite a long time, and it can take a number of weeks for the medicine to work, sometimes 8 to 12 weeks before it reduces the anxiety symptoms. So while you're waiting for it to work, you need to remember to keep on taking the medicine really regularly. I spoke before about personality change and the fact that it's actually very common. One of the challenges with personality change is how we're going to manage it. There is no specific part of the brain that controls personality, but we do know that the frontal lobes are very important for controlling how people behave and think about things. So we think that damage to the frontal lobes is very important for personality change. Now there's a problem in that, where if you remember back to looking at the brain and the skull, the frontal lobes are at the front of the brain, and so often when you have a car accident or you have a fall, what tends to happen is the brain moves and hits the front of the skull and causes bruising in the frontal areas and possibly damage. So personality change is going to be really common after a brain injury. It can be quite subtle or very obvious. Sometimes people's personality actually improves after a brain injury. So I've seen cases where people say, oh, they're much nicer, they're far easier to get on with, they're a lot calmer. And that's nice if it happens, but unfortunately, in the majority of cases, the personality change isn't a positive one. And typically, the ones that people focus on are the changes in personality where people become quite aggressive, paranoid and irritable. They can also be quite disinhibited and more childlike in their behaviour. We don't have any specific treatment for the personality changes that occur. Sometimes the combination of behaviour therapy and medication can settle down some of the problems, but we don't have any particular kind of cure. For a lot of the difficult behaviour changes that occur after a brain injury, the aggressive personalities, people typically use medicines that we use to treat epilepsy. And Tegretol and Epilum are the two commonest medications that might be prescribed for people who have personality change and tend to be quite aggressive and irritable. There are a number of other treatments that we can use for specific symptoms after a brain injury that don't really fit the groupings of various mental health problems. For example, after a brain injury, people can often be very fatigued. They very easily get tired. Now, these fatigue problems can be mistaken for depression, or they can in fact occur in combination with depression. Treating the depression is actually quite easy because antidepressants are very safe and easy to use. But if a person has had antidepressants and they still have a lot of problems with fatigue and the person can't manage the fatigue, for example, they can't have a rest in the middle of the day, then sometimes we will use medication to control that fatigue or to make it better. And the typical medications are listed there. Modavigil is the most modern drug to be used for the treatment of fatigue, but at present it's very expensive and so not that many people can use it. One of the issues about treating fatigue with medication is that it doesn't fix the underlying problem. So if a person has a problem with fatigue and they're taking medication, the fatigue catches up with them when the medication wears off. You can't take medicine for fatigue 24 hours a day because it interferes with your sleeping. The other area that might be treated with medication is the problems where people have difficulties with initiating activity, they don't concentrate very well, or sometimes for memory problems. There's some very exciting research happening overseas where people are using drugs that we normally use to treat dementia, such as Alzheimer's disease, and we're giving this to people who've had a brain injury. And sometimes it actually helps solve some of the problems with behaviour, poor concentration, or the fact that they have a problem initiating or their motivation is low. The medication doesn't work for every person, but sometimes it will. As well, we can use some of the stimulant drugs like dexamphetamine and methylphenidate will also sometimes work for the initiative problems. If the problems with initiative and fatigue are severe, it's important for you to talk about it with your rehabilitation specialist, your case manager, because there may be some treatment that can be tried. It's always important to remember, though, that these treatments don't actually cure the underlying problem, and once you start treatment, you've got to make the decision as to how long you want to continue with the treatment. Drug and alcohol problems are something that we do need to talk about. Firstly, drug and alcohol problems can actually cause mental health problems in their own right. If you drink too much alcohol, or if you use too much marijuana, you can actually get a mental health problem or a mental illness. One of the other things, though, is that unfortunately a lot of brain injuries are actually associated with the use of drugs or alcohol. In some studies, up to 70% of people who've had a brain injury, alcohol has some role to play in the brain injury. Either the person was intoxicated and driving, or the person was intoxicated, hit by a car, crossing a road, falling, doing something impulsive. Drugs such as ecstasy or speed can also change how a person thinks and increase the risk of causing a brain injury. If you've got a drug and alcohol problem and then you have a brain injury, sometimes this can be a real challenge in terms of your rehabilitation because you might crave to use the drugs or alcohol to try and deal with your problems from the brain injury itself. One of the things that does happen after a brain injury is that if you previously could drink 6 beers and not have a problem, when you have your brain injury, you drink 1 beer and you've got a problem because your brain's tolerance to the alcohol is really reduced. What's really difficult, though, is that you often don't notice that your tolerance to the alcohol is reduced, so other people can see it, but you don't necessarily see it. And something that I see a lot in my practice is people who, after one or two drinks, have what we call now an alcoholic blackout, where after they've had one or two drinks, they don't remember anything that they've done, and they can become aggressive or put themselves in situations where at the risk of being hurt. So we usually ask people not to use drugs or alcohol after they've had their brain injury because the brain doesn't deal with it as well as it used to. If you've got a mental health problem from your brain injury and you try and treat it with drugs and alcohol, it often stops the treatment that the doctors or therapists are giving you, and also it seems to make the mental health problem worse. Finally, something to remember is that when you've had a brain injury, often you've lost a number of nerve cells. You have what we call reduced neuronal reserve. So if you think about it like a pie, you've had a brain injury and you lose a piece of that pie, so you've got less pie left to do what you need it to do. If you then drink alcohol, you can actually damage the brain, and so you're going to be losing more and more cells, so the problems can be greater. One of the particular drugs that can cause a problem with this is ecstasy. Now, ecstasy is a drug that a lot of young people use in parties. They enjoy the sensation it gives them, but it in fact kills brain cells in its own right. So if you've already lost brain cells from a brain injury, you probably don't want to be making it worse by using these drugs as well. One of the drugs that people might use after a brain injury that they don't think of as a drug are in fact painkillers. Now, painkillers are actually really commonly prescribed after a brain injury. And the reason that is that people with brain injuries may have headaches, or as part of their accident, they've had damage to other parts of their body, for example, their back or their legs or their arms, and they've got pain. When they're in hospital, they're started on the painkillers, and when they leave hospital, the painkillers are continued. You might think, well, they're prescribed by doctors, so they're safe, so there isn't a problem. Well, most painkillers are in fact highly addictive, and if you take them for more than about 6 weeks, if you try and stop taking the painkillers, you will get physical symptoms that are associated with a withdrawal. Painkillers can also slow down your memory and make it harder for you to learn new material or new information. And often in a brain injury, you have to learn lots of new things as to how to recover. So painkillers can affect that. Painkillers can also affect how you perform in various tests, like the memory test that some of your therapists might do. So it's important to try and remember to tell people if you're taking painkillers and try and take as little as possible. Sometimes after physical therapies, you might need to take a bit of painkillers because the physical therapy is causing some pain initially, but it's important always to try and limit it. If you have pain for more than about 6 months, you have something we call chronic pain. And most of the painkillers that we prescribe don't work in chronic pain. Now you may be hearing this and think, oh yes, I know, I take my Endone and it works. But in fact, probably what happens is that the Endone dulls your senses and maybe helps you to go to sleep, but it doesn't actually reduce the amount of pain that you're experiencing. It just reduces your brain's ability to feel or process that pain. So typically, when you've got pain for more than about 6 months, we recommend other ways of dealing with this chronic pain apart from taking painkillers. For example, you might see a psychologist and work out some ways of how to cope better with your pain. You might learn ways to manage the pain, for example, exercise or restricting the amount of activity and not trying to push through the pain barrier. Painkillers will increase the amount of depression that a person can have and can actually make your memory a lot worse after a brain injury. Not permanently, only while they're there, but nevertheless enough to cause problems in terms of how you're going to deal with your rehabilitation. One very important warning that you may not know about, and in fact your doctor may not know about because this is only a fairly new discovery, is that the medication Tramadol, which is now very commonly prescribed for pain, doesn't mix with antidepressants. The combination of the two can produce some very nasty side effects and make you quite ill. So if you're taking Tramadol and the doctor wants to start you on an antidepressant, you need to tell them. And if they doctors feel you need to start antidepressants and you're taking Tramadol, you might have to be changed to another medication. Very briefly, I just want to very quickly talk about natural therapies. Natural therapies are now having an increasing acceptance in our community. Most of you at one stage may have been recommended by a family friend or someone else to try a natural therapy. People might say to you, well, the medicine hasn't helped, the doctors haven't helped, why don't you try my naturopath? And there's no problem with looking at natural therapies and seeing whether they can help you with your problem, but there are a few important things to remember. If you're taking any form of natural therapy, anything you can buy in a health food shop, a chemist, or that you've obtained from your naturopath, it's important to tell your other doctors what you're taking. Because sometimes the medicines that other doctors are using will interact with the natural therapies. Now you might be puzzled about this and think, well, no, the natural therapies can't do me any harm. Most of the medicines that we now use in our society originally were in fact derived from plants. So for example, you can get a compound that's like aspirin from willow bark. And so the original aspirin, in fact, was derived from plants. Drugs that were used to treat heart conditions originally started from plants as well. There's a very long tradition of taking medicines from plants, and in fact, a lot of research now happens in countries like South America, looking for plants that can provide us with chemicals for more modern medical treatments. And so naturopaths are, in fact, using this knowledge about plants and how they can help us to provide treatments. The naturopath's treatments therefore contain active chemicals, and those active chemicals can interact with the medicines that your other doctors might be prescribing. Another important thing to remember is because they do contain active chemicals, they can cause side effects. The majority of naturopaths use the doses of their medicines very low to try and avoid getting side effects, but you can have an allergic reaction, And you can have quite a significant side effect from naturopathic therapy. So if you've gone to a chemist and obtained something like St John's wort, started taking it and become sick, it may well be your St John's wort and you need to go and talk to a doctor or a qualified naturopath to get a bit of an understanding about what you're doing and what you're taking. You might have found in the past when you've mentioned an interest in natural therapies that the doctor that you've seen has been very negative about that. There's a lot of education going on with medical practitioners to help them to understand how natural therapy can work in conjunction or can be complementary to more traditional medicine. If your doctor has expressed a negative viewpoint about your natural therapy, don't allow that to be a barrier of telling your doctor what you're taking, because the risk of not telling the doctor what you're taking is probably more than the risk of telling them, because if you don't tell them, they might prescribe something that can make you very sick. Now, I've spoken about the different mental health problems and the different types of treatments that we can use, and you might think at the end of this, oh good, this is a problem that we can easily solve. Well, there are some challenges as far as the treatment's concerned of mental health problems after a brain injury. There are some challenges that happen to the person who's actually got the mental health problem and a brain injury. And I spoke to you earlier before about a problem called awareness or insight. So if a person doesn't recognise that they've got the problem, it can be very hard to get them to have the treatment or for the person to comply with the treatment. Usually the therapist will be aware of the problems with regards to awareness, and they will actually do some special therapy to try and increase the person's awareness about their problems. Another challenge that you might have as far as getting help is that there aren't a lot of experts or any experts in your area that can help you to make the diagnosis and to manage the problem. There are a number of sources of information, and typically your local brain injury service will know of someone who has an interest in brain injury and mental health problems and be able to lead you in the right direction for getting help. While it can be really hard to talk to people about mental health problems, and sometimes you might meet people who are less enlightened and be very negative about it, if you've listened to this talk and you think, yes, this could be me, persist and I'm sure you'll find someone who'll be able to help you. Finally, carers who take care of people with brain injury can get their own mental health problems, and that can make it much harder for the carer to actually care. The risk of mental health problems in carers is really high, and so if you're a carer listening to this talk and you can identify with some of the symptoms, particularly the depression, which can be a huge problem for carers, again, it's important to go and talk to someone about it and be aware that you can get help. Mental health services may not be your first port of call, and they might be quite resistant to treating a mental health problem from a brain injury, because they're going to say, oh no, that's a brain injury problem and not a mental health problem. When you confront this situation, go back to your mental health team, go back to your brain injury team and actually get the brain injury specialist to talk to the mental health specialist, and often those barriers of communication can be readily and easily overcome. What I've now spoken about in this short time is just a very brief overview about some of the mental health problems that people can have after a brain injury. I focused on the problems such as depression, psychosis, anxiety, and the personality changes. It's important to know that brain injury in its own right can increase the risk of a person to have a mental health problem, but not every person who has a brain injury will get a mental health problem. If you've got a family history of mental health problems, the person's had a mental health problem before their brain injury, abused drugs or alcohol, they're likely to be at a greater risk of getting a mental illness and need to have treatment. Diagnosis can be quite a challenge, so don't give up. If you think there is something wrong, keep on persisting. I'm sure you'll find the help eventually. And to remember that the treatment's actually fairly simple, it's quite straightforward, and that most of the mental health problems that people get after a brain injury, if not easily treatable, can be made a lot better, and that most of the treatments are reasonably well acceptable and don't have too many side effects. And finally, if you're a carer listening to this talk and you have a mental health problem, go and get some help for it, because it'll make it much easier for you to be a carer and to take care of the person in your family that's had a brain injury. Now, one of the most important sources of information for people who've had a brain injury or their family members is that of the New South Wales Brain Injury Association. If you are listening to this talk and you are from another state of New South Wales, then your local area will also have a brain injury association. You can ring the Brain Injury Association of New South Wales, and they provide a vast source of information where there are support groups, where there may be a person who specialises in managing mental health problems and brain injury, and where you can get access to respite facilities and help with a lot of issues such as employment. If you have access to the internet, they can be found over the internet, and the site is really user-friendly. So it's always really important to remember that mental health problems do happen after a brain injury. Not everyone with a brain injury has a mental health problem, and that there is help at hand.